Welcome to episode number 13 of the Board Game OK podcast, a podcast about board games and the hobby of board gaming, recorded in sunny Helsinki, Finland. I'm your co-host Jonas, and with me is my co-host Luis.
Hello everyone.
In this episode, we will discuss who has the right to start a podcast and review board games. But before we get to that, we will review the full catalog of Wurlikick games, Pax Pamir 2nd Edition, John Company 2nd Edition, and Molly House. Luis, what do you know about Wurlikick games?
Well, I did not know that this was the full catalog of their games. I know that it's a company from the Wurl brothers, like Cole Wurley, the designer of all of these games, or co-designer of all of these games. And also his brother, I think.
That is true. The company was started by Cole Wurley and his brother, Drew Wurley.
Okay. That's all I know about the company. Tell us more. Yep. Or is there more to know?
Cole Wurley is a famous board game designer, most notably known for Root. Kind of like the mission of Wurlikick Games is to publish high-quality historical games. And it started as a side hustle. Cole kind of wanted to have like a little bit more autonomy over the design and publishing of his games. But their first game, Pax Pamir, turned out to be a much bigger success than they expected. I wouldn't say Wurlikick Games is a massive board game publisher, but at least it is known in the hobby.
But isn't it so that they only publish the second editions, like the first editions were published by somebody else?
That is true. So today we'll be reviewing Pax Pamir 2nd Edition that was first released by Sierra Madre Games. And then John Company was first released by who, Luis? You will be reviewing John Company.
John Company 1st Edition it's published by Sierra Madre Games.
Yep. I think Infamous Traffic was published by Holland Games.
Mm-hmm.
Or is it Holland Spiele? And Infamous Traffic is another historical board game designed by Cole Wurley. I think there might be a second edition coming at some point, but if there is one coming, I would assume it's probably Wurlikick Games that will publish that game.
All right. And when you say that the Pax Pamir was really popular, you mean the second edition, the one that they published was the one that became more popular, right?
Exactly. Pax Pamir 2nd Edition was a big success on Kickstarter.
Got it.
Okay. As said, Pax Pamir 2nd Edition is the very first game released by Wurlikick Games. It's set in the 19th century Afghanistan during the power struggle between the Russian and British empires over Central Asia. The players are neither Russian nor British forces, but local Afghan leaders who try to manipulate the powers for their own gain. The game mechanic that seems to stand out the most in Pax Pamir is the loyalty mechanic. At the start of the game, you have to choose whether you will be loyal to the Russian or the British or the Afghan empire. Loyalty lets you add units for that empire and control those units on your turn. But the big twist is that you can change loyalty as the game progresses. In addition to the units and the map of Central Asia on which those units move, you have a card market where most of the game tends to happen. The market consists of 12 cards that the players can buy to add into their hands and tableaus. Some of the cards are events, and some of the cards are dominance cards that trigger scoring. There's two ways to score in Pax Pamir 2nd Edition. If one of the empires has four more pieces than other empires, then the players who are the most loyal to that empire gain points. If none of the empires are dominant, then the players who have placed the most of their own pieces get to score points. Luis, what's your take on Pax Pamir 2nd Edition?
I think it's a very fun game with a very complex rule. Like, it's very complex to understand, like, when and how you should change your loyalty and how those things interact with each other. I think the game, in essence, it's quite simple to play and quite simple to like, okay, yeah, I'll do this. But mastering and knowing like when is the right time to kind of interact with that loyalty mechanics and change your loyalty and maybe break your loyalty, that's quite complex. But I think it's a great game that is worth playing.
For me, one thing that has been consistent in all of my plays and has always been fun is the table talk that happens around the table. Because the way the scoring works, you kind of need to constantly make these temporary alliances to prevent one player from triggering the scoring immediately. And these alliances aren't like these tit-for-tat alliances, you know, but alliances where you both know that you will betray each other as soon as you get the opportunity. But the reason why you help each other out is that, well, this way, both of you will have at least a running chance of being the big scorer for this round, instead of you both being out of the game. And this means that there will be a lot of coordination and deal making with the players, but at the same time, very little those feel bad moments, because you know, you always know when that betrayal is coming. Have you ever felt Pax Premier to be restrictive?
I felt that sometimes if the cards are not there that you need, then you can be quite stuck with what you have currently. Of course, I don't know the game enough to be able to know like, okay, then that's the time to change loyalties. Mm-hmm. And then you need to pivot or something like that.
Yep. I think in your first games, you can usually find yourself being stuck. And I don't think it's necessarily a situation where you don't know what action to take next. You just kind of see that every action I take is a bad action. Like, I cannot get out of this hole.
Mm.
And there is like a little bit of luck involved regarding like when do those different cards come to the market. But even though there might be some cards that then, you know, work a little bit better for you, that you might get a little bit luckier with the card draws, if you're out of the game, you are out of the game. There's no way about it. But with experience, you will learn how to avoid these situations. Basically, what you need to start doing if you want to get better at the game is to read the card market better and remember what cards people have in their hands. All of the cards belong to a specific region. And if you make sure you are the only one with cards from, let's say, Kandahar, you are in a powerful position because other players have very limited ways of messing with you. So you could, for example, play the game by making sure that you are able to dominate a single region while preventing any one player from getting dominance in any other region.
Mm.
And I will guarantee that this type of play will prevent those finding yourself in a hole or finding yourself being stuck situations. But I'm not saying that this is the way to win the game every time, but this feels like a strategy that will put you in contention for a win almost every time. This type of play, at least for me, is very taxing because you really have to push the limits of your working memory as you try to track what's happening with the cards. And honestly speaking, for me, the better I get in Pax Pamir, the less fun I might have as the game is more and more work, mentally speaking. And you mentioned earlier about the rules that they're like a little bit complex. But I would say that out of all the three games we are going to talk about today, Pax Pamir 2nd Edition has the simplest rule set. But while the rules are simple, keeping track of the board state and making sure you are not missing any of the admin is a lot harder. The two things that are very easy to miss, for me at least, is having to remove your tribes from a region if you lose the last political card and vice versa, and then paying double for the cards if the military suit is the active suit. Just a couple of examples of things that are like very easy to miss.
Mm.
And when you combine this stuff with the importance of tracking the cards, as I mentioned earlier, you do sometimes feel like the game is not your friend at all. What do you think about the theme?
Well, the theme is a pretty interesting theme. It's a theme that I would never have thought to think about, to be honest. Coming from Mexico and maybe having a different type of historical education and maybe not being a history buff, I would never have considered that historical era in that particular region without having engaged with the game.
Yeah, and Pax Pamir, it wouldn't be Pax Pamir without its theme. I think that's like the big thing that brings people into the game.
Mm-hmm.
And the narrative that Pax Pamir has, it feels very different to what we usually see in Western media. And mainly what I mean by this is that Pax Pamir feels like it has this anti-noble savage thesis built into it. The players are local leaders who are, in a sense, victims of these big invading empires, but you feel much less like victims and more like powers who are manipulating these empires for your own purposes. But are you the good guys or are you the bad guys in Pax Pamir? Like, that's really up to the player themselves to decide. That was Pax Pamir 2nd Edition.
All right, now I'm going to talk about John Company 2nd Edition, a game of 2022 by designer Cole Worley, which all of these games are, by BGG, the most complex game in this trio of games, complexity rating of currently 4.46 out of 5. This is the complexity rating of John Company.
And that's very high.
That is a very high complexity rating. I'm going to do not a great job at explaining the game because I think the game is so complex that it's really hard to explain in a 10-minute review. But if you ever have the chance, I would recommend to watch the Shut Up and Sit Down video in YouTube. I think they do a great game of talking about the game, the complexity of the game, the theme of the game, which can be quite divisive and quite, it can be quite divisive. Like, some people don't like the theme because it's a theme of colonialism. And I think that's something interesting that I'm going to touch a little bit about in my review. But basically, in John Company, players assume the roles of ambition families attempting to use the British East India Company for personal gain. This is the description, the first phrase in Board Game Geek. I think this is game, and I'm going to start with saying this, this is a masterpiece of board game design that goes far beyond your traditional gaming experiences. It's said a little bit on the first page of the rules that is created as a frank portrait of one of history's most dysfunctional and influential institutions. And this game immerses the players in a complex world of the East India Trading Company during the 18th and 19th centuries. And of course, this comes with the abuse of power, with the abuse of colonial power and the exploitation of, in this particular game, the Indian country in that time period. So for sure, it's a game that has a very complex theme. However, I think this game engages with that theme in an interesting way. It asks you to kind of role play a little bit the part of these families where they don't really care. And therefore, for them, it's a game. And you're playing a game with the lives of people and the looting of the different regions and the exploitation of the different regions in India. And this is basically what you're doing. Of course, some people might not care about theme in their game. Some people might care a lot, which might be that the theme is like a non-starter for the game. But I think this is something that has to be said as part of a review of John Company's second edition. Now, the game is indeed complex, and its structure is comprised of many different phases of the game that you have to play one at a time. But I would, for the purpose of this review, divide it in three primary phases: pre-company actions, company actions, and post-company actions. So in the pre-company phase, there is a London season where you kind of, during not the first round, but during the secondary rounds, you are like retiring people from the different positions, trying to get them to retire in a very lofty palaces that will give you victory points. Then you are having family actions, which basically are your chance to position yourself in order to do better during the company phase and during subsequent rounds of the game, where like family actions can be like, okay, seeking shares in the joint company or in the company, maybe sending riders or sending officers to the army, or buying shipyards or buying different types of companies that are available during the game, which will give you different things. Then during the company phase, or what I would consider the company phase, there are two main phases of the company action, which is like hiring phase and the actual company actions. And in the hiring phase, you're basically choosing who's going to take responsibility of each one of the departments or the areas of the company. You are first choosing the chairman out of the people that have shares in the company. Then you're choosing, the chairman chooses the director of trade, the military affairs leader, the shipping manager, and then all of these different positions can then choose the lower positions during the game. So I haven't said this, but the game is a balance of, it's a super negotiation heavy game, but also it's an economic game, and it is a gambling game in a way. This is where the negotiation happens. It's like if you're hiring the chairman, it might be you don't have the biggest shares of the board, but if you have different positions that might benefit other members of the team, then you can, or members of the company, you can convince people, hey, let me be the chairman. I'll act for the good of the company. Or if you don't want the company to do good, it's like, hey, let me be the chairman. I can maybe ruin the company in some way, shape, or form. Then after the hiring phase, where you're like choosing the different positions of the company, you go into the company actions. And each different position has different actions to take. The chairman gets the money and distributes the money. The director of trade can open trade in different areas and use the money that the chairman gave them to open trade into China and open the different positions. The director of shipping can move people around. The military affairs officers can move army members around. And then the president of the different regions of India can like allocate money, can decide like what to trade or not to trade, or can decide whether or not the commander has enough money to do their actions. So I know I'm doing a very bad job at explaining the rules of the game, but this is where the game becomes so complex. It's like, first of all, you're trying to see into the future of like, what should I do, or who should I choose as a chairman in order for me to do better? Because once we choose the chairman, that chairman might actually mess my entire game if I'm not careful. And how to decide that is like, okay, what does the chairman make the decision? Okay, if the chairman chooses a director of trade, that director of trade can then help the chairman in another position to put them in a better chance to do better at the job. And at the same time, if you, for some reason, spite another team member, then that different position can really affect you down the line. And understanding how these different positions interact with each other and how the money that you are allocating to the different positions can actually affect what you can do in each role can be quite complex, especially your very first round. So complex that the very first time that you play the game, they suggest to do a rolling teach. It's like, hey, so one person needs to know the rules and then just explain as the game goes and just like kind of wing it. Like the first few rounds, you're not going to make, you're not going to be sure what you're doing, but you're like eventually going to get it. Anyway, and then after the company actions, you have the third phase that, as I would call it, with the post-company actions, where you are having the revenue check, where you're like paying the cost for the company. You have the events in India, which can be storms that destroy ships, different turmoil in different regions, which can potentially lose you lives of the people that you have in India, and loss of territory as well. And then at the end, you have a parliamentary session where you're voting for different laws, which you can use your company, the influence of your companies and money to pass laws that can benefit the company, benefit yourself, or at least affect you in a hopefully positive way. What do you think about the Junk Company?
Yeah, I heard Cole Worley mention that Junk Company is the game he would like to pull out in the late hours of a convention with his friends when, you know, it's time for that last big game of the night. And we kind of tried doing something like that last year in a convention. And I have to say that that game felt like a bit of a disaster. We struggled with all the event card rules. And instead of really focusing on the negotiations, I felt that we had to just keep consulting the rule book a lot.
Yeah, for sure. I think we made a mistake of doing that well after having not played it for a long time. I think if we were to do that now, I think maybe we would be more successful about it. So I would be willing to try again this next Ropecon with hopefully mostly people that know the game already. I think having to teach one person out of maybe five people that already know the game and having to teach one person then might be counterproductive for the gaming experience. However, while this game is really complex and I would not necessarily recommend owning this game yourself, I think this is a game that everybody that is in the hobby needs to play at least once in their life and hopefully two or three times to give it like chance to explore the mechanics, the intricacy of the game in order to explore like what this game is maybe trying to tell you and what this game is trying to be. I think it's one of these games that when we were talking about whether the games are art or not, I think this is one of those games where at least the artist or the designer, Cole Worley, tried to create a work of art, try to evoke some sentiments on the player, try to create a thing that transcends just traditional board gaming. This could just be considered a negotiation game, but then it just misses the point of the theme and the looting and the interactions with the other members of the different families of the game, where like, I think Shut Up and Sit Down says it, like sometimes if somebody spites you, you're not going to do what's best for the company. You're just going to do what's worse for that player. And that's kind of how people maybe took their roles in this it's India company, according at least to the designer or what the designer is trying to say. Where it's like, yeah, this is just sometimes a game of greed and a game of like trying to do what's best for yourself and not care about the lives of other people or the members of the company. So I think I didn't do a great service to the game, but I think this is a fantastic game that everybody should play at least a few times in order to experience something unique. What do you think, Jonas?
Yeah, I kind of want to talk a little bit more about the negotiations.
Okay.
Especially since there is this thing in a joint company that you can be pro-company or anti-company. Basically meaning that you will either benefit if the company tanks, meaning that you have a chance to win, or you will have a chance of winning if the company succeeds.
Yeah.
And how do you find this dynamic? Which side do you like to be on?
I have always played being company first. Mm-hmm. I don't think I've ever been in a position where I'm not invested in the company enough in order to be able to tank the company and win. So I do think that this is something that is really dependent on how you start the game and maybe the very first few rounds where like whether or not you're going to be pro-company or anti-company. And I think this really... it's interesting because you can position yourself in a way that maybe you have an alliance with somebody else that is anti-company or pro-company that try to kind of push people away from positions that are not beneficial for you to have for them to have them. Yeah, if somebody's trying to tank the company, you can position yourself in a place where like you would prevent them from being responsible for important positions where they could really affect the company. I think this happens once with Simone, where we knew that Simone wanted to tank the company and we're like, they're not going to give Simone the director of trade position or something like that.
I played Junk Company four times. I think two out of those times I have been trying to tank the company, or maybe even like three times. And I guess for me, it's in the past been very easy to like jump to the short side because I feel that whenever you see that you're not doing as well as others, and you see that you don't have as many shares as the others have, it's just kind of like simple math. Mm-hmm. You decide like, well, I'm going to take the company.
Yeah.
And I've been put into those important positions where it comes to my turn and people are expecting to do a lot of trading. And I'm just saying that, no, we're actually not going to do any trading.
Yeah.
And I think there's like, those moments are somewhat fun to be in those positions, but it's not, hasn't always been fun for me because I feel that I'm like pushed or forced into the position or the game forces me into that position. And then I'm just trying to find a way how to make the game end instead of like doing these elaborate negotiations and having fun with others. And at some point, because of this, I was really ready to let go of Chunk Company forever, like never playing it again. But our last play, which happened after the convention this year, it really changed my mind. Because it was actually you who gave me that strategic tip that, you know, like a good way to play Chunk Company as a beginner is to focus on something that no one else is doing and do a lot of that. And I decided to give it a try. So I built a lot of shipyards because no one else was building shipyards. And all of a sudden, the game turned from this like constant struggle into something that, you know, I can have like a lot of control over other people and I can be in this position of power. And it's much more fun to negotiate from a position of power instead of from a weak position because it means that you can say no to some people. And it doesn't, and I'm not saying that you need to kind of like ask more and more from other people. It's just that you can make a reasonable deal because I feel like oftentimes if you're in the weak position, others will smell the blood in the water. They see that you're weak and they will give you one deal and they will push it too far and you don't want to take that deal because that's going to lose you the game. So then they say no. And then you have to kind of take that deal because that will let you have some small chance of like being in the top in the end of the game.
Yeah.
But yeah, now I find the game so much more fun and enjoyable. And yeah, I'm actually really looking forward to my next play.
Yeah. Same here. So that is Chunk Company 2nd Edition.
Molly House is the latest Wurlik game. Unlike Pax Premier and Chunk Company, Molly House is not a solo design by Cole Wurley, but instead it's a co-design between Joe Kelly and Cole Wurley. In addition, Molly House is not a second edition of a previously released game, but a completely new design. And unlike Pax Premier and Chunk Company, Molly House is not about colonialism, but gay communities in 18th century London. In Molly House, players are, quote, pioneering explorers of gender and sexuality. You try to collect the most joy, aka victory points, by throwing parties and cruising back alleys. But since this is the 18th century London, these kinds of activities are something you can get hanged for. In the game, there will be constables snooping around and indictments that can at best cause you to lose a couple of points and at worst lose you the whole game. Molly House consists of the central board where players move their pieces by rolling dice, and the cards that look very much like a regular deck of cards. On your turn, you roll the dice and choose where you want to move on the board. After that, you take an action that can be as simple as drawing one more card into your hand from the draw deck, and if you land on any of the corners of the board, you can throw a festivity. During a festivity, we draw two cards from the draw deck, and players play up to two cards from their own hand. After that, we check what is the best poker hand we can construct from the played cards. The available poker hands are a straight flush of four cards, a queen and a three of a kind, and a jack and a straight of three cards. If a card that you played contributes to the best possible chosen poker hand, you get to score points for that card. And if you can't make a poker hand of any of the cards, your party turns into a quiet gathering, and the four lowest cards get scored. I have now played Molly House three times at three players, four players, and five players. My very first game of Molly House was with you, Luis. What did you think of Molly House?
Yeah, that's the only time I played it. I thought it was pretty fun. I won the game and I liked it, but I think we played it wrong. So I think we missed a couple of important rules of what you could, you couldn't do. So we played it consistently at least, but consistently wrong. So with that in mind, I cannot really say about the real Molly House. But I really enjoyed it. I thought it was like simple, complex in the decision making and in their interactions with things, but like simple mechanics that is like, okay, like it's one of the simplest games. Though, again, as with other games, the complexity comes in the decision making and knowing how things interact with each other. But yeah, I really liked it. I would love to play again.
There is a simplicity to Molly House, but there are also some really finicky rules. Yes, the first time we played together, we made 3 rules mistakes in our first game. And I would say that those rules mistakes were pretty big. However, they did not break the game. And after playing Molly House 2 more times, I can say that the mood of the game does stay the same. But yeah, if you want to get Molly House, I would maybe advise you to not only read the rulebook, but also watch a playthrough to see if you have gotten everything right. Because I have also heard a lot of people making those rules mistakes. And there is also a community-made flowchart for how to deal with constables and rogue cards. And I really recommend printing out that flowchart. That is going to make things a lot easier. What did you think about roll and movement in a board game in 2025?
I didn't love it. I thought that while it didn't affect my game almost always, there was a couple of times where and especially towards the end of the game, where because of what I rolled, I could not do what would be best for my strategy and I was very limited. I did not love that, but at the same time, it was maybe not super bad, but I could see how that a very bad roll at the end of the game or a couple of bad rolls at the end of the game can ruin your entire game and experience maybe even.
Yeah, it might be that I have not been burnt by the dice. There's definitely been moments where I would have wanted to go somewhere else, but now I can't go there. But I feel that the tempo of the game is something that can limit you much more and that you feel that you can get screwed by in this game. You can really feel like you are not catching a break as people are throwing the parties when you don't have the cards. And once you have the cards, then no one else has the cards and they don't want to party with you. And also in the very end of the game, when you have your indictments and you're rolling your dice to see whether you're going to get hanged or just lose a couple points, that's also very random. However, I have had 0 issues with this. I don't know what it is, but for me, Molly House hits this perfect balance of randomness and strategic play. Just like a lot of trick takers, where there is room for good plays, but at the end of the day, the cards might just get dealt the wrong way, or the dice might roll the wrong way. So you never take things too seriously, yet you always try your best. And with all the table talk and trying to find those good plays, I had a lot of fun with every single game of Molly House. What do you think about the theme of Molly House compared to Pax Pamir and Chunk Company? How did that game make you feel as a player?
I thought it was fantastic. Again, one of those themes that, well, maybe a bit more common to interact with like queerness and openness nowadays, it was something I would have never thought about, like the queer communities of London in the 18th century. Yeah, I thought it was a great, again, exploration of a theme that I would not have thought that much about. And yeah, it felt like, while of course there is the intricacies of like a house maybe being kind of discovered and raided and people being hanged, which of course it's like, it's quite serious. I think in general, the getting joy as victory points and throwing parties, it's like, it's kind of a festive theme with like also considering like, hey, being festive in a queer way in that time was risky.
Yeah, absolutely. In Pax Pamir, Chunk Company, and Molly House, all the people are depicted as these like imperfect beings, even though you could kind of see that, okay, who are like the good guys, who are the bad guys, maybe a little bit. But everyone is imperfect. And there's that like little history leaflet in Molly House that I was reading the last time we played while Simone was doing his teach. I had heard the teach so many times, so I just like looked at the leaflet. And it was so interesting to read about these characters that had kind of like snitched their friends and former lovers. And, you know, like they knew that the sentence is hanging. Even though in Molly House, you kind of like start as the good guys. But then since you're really gambling with your life and you might end up turning into an informant so that you can live while, you know, others hang. Yeah, so there is almost like this personal arc that can happen for you in that game. You know, you start as very much looking for that joy and then scared of death at the end of the game.
Yeah.
And I honestly love how there is this mechanical connection to this feeling because Molly House has this very strong pusher-like element to it. Like you are so tempted to just let loose and party and cruise and not care about the indictments at all. And then everything can change in one turn. That was Molly House by Joe Kelly and Cole Worley. When we started this podcast, I wanted to be really certain that Board Game OK is not going to be one of those two dudes think their discussions are interesting type of podcast people like to make fun of. So I actually took a course on how to become a certified board game reviewer. Unfortunately, after I had paid for the course, I learned that there is no such thing as a certified board game reviewer. And apparently anyone can just write or record a board game review, call it critique, and post it online. So obviously, this kind of thing is like super dangerous for society and everyday people like you and me. And because of that, me and Luis thought that we could discuss about what should be the requirements for becoming a board game critic. Luis, where do you want to start?
I want to say something first. I want to say that while there can be certifications and we can gatekeep who can be a board game critic, I think everybody has a right to be a board game reviewer because you can present the board game review however your experience is. Like if you're new to the hobby, you can present a review as like, hey, these are my hot takes as a new board game player about this board game. And that can be as valid a review if you present it as that as any other review online. However, we are doing this and my requirements are if you want to be a serious board game reviewer, mm-hmm. that like people should hear, okay? That you have like some element of seniority or how do you call it? Like
authority?
Authority, yes. Okay, the very first requirement I think is you should play a lot of games. It's maybe a duh requirement, but I think that's just mandatory.
Why do you need to play a lot of games?
Because you need to play games in order to know what games are or what different games. If you have only played 2-3 games and then you want to be a board game reviewer, then how can you compare with the different games that are out there? How can you kind of know if a game is good or not? Again, like I think you can always say your experience with as many games as you played. But I think in order to be able to draw better conclusions, to be able to compare games with each other, to be able to have a more critical opinion about a game, you need to play many, many games, right? It also helps you maybe understand games better and criticize games better. If you have played only one strategic game, then maybe you will have maybe it will be a bad strategic game and you will say like, yeah, strategic games suck. And it's like, okay, well, maybe not that particular game sucked, but you have no point of comparison.
And then what is a lot of games? You mentioned 3 is too few. Is 6 a lot of games or does it have to be 600?
I think it has to be at least 100. I don't know what the exact number. And I think actually most of my requirements in my list are about playing games.
I had something similar to that, which is kind of this like knowledge of the classics. So you kind of like need to know what is the bar games need to hit in order to be something worth paying attention to. And this means that you need to know what are considered to be those best of in a selected category. And you mentioned earlier that, yeah, you can start reviewing even when you like start playing your first board game to kind of like have this review to be this like experience that you're sharing with others. But I feel that then the review comes off as very gonzo. You know, yeah. It's very about like your individual experience instead of like maybe letting others know how does this game compare to other things. And then also like, you know, maybe shining light to yeah. elements that might not be present in other games.
Yeah, and whether this game is worth exploring versus the myriad of other games that are available for you to explore.
As an example, one could play Harvest, a worker placement game set in a fictional farming community with, anthropomorphic animals. And if that's the first worker placement game you play, you might think to yourself like, wow, this is an amazing game. But first, maybe you play Agricola so that you know who is the kind of like the granddaddy here.
I think like I will just expand on that where my second requirement was like play a lot of different games. Don't only play strategic games. Don't only play worker placement games. Don't only play trick-taking games. I think if you only play trick-taking games, then you will be able to make comparisons between trick-taking games, but not expand into that. And I think the more games you play and different types of games, then start expanding this knowledge, which is basically what we already said. And then maybe I'm already going to jump into the third, which is...
Well, before you jump into the third, can I ask a question
here?
So what if you think about Taylor's Trick-Taking Table, a YouTube channel that's all about trick-takers, or other review outlets that are all about just like this one particular type of game, like only about war games, for example?
That is great. And then if your niche is just war game review, like I'm a war game reviewer, it's the same as like, hey, I'm a first time hobby inductee board game reviewer, which mm-hmm. is like you present yourself as something different than a general board game critiquer and reviewer. We want to be more generalist and we are trying to share our opinion about the hobby in general, right? Like that's in the slogan of our podcast. And therefore that requires like diversifying and playing a lot of different things. However, yeah, if you just are a solo board gamer or a trick taker board gamer, and that's the reviews that you're trying to present, then that's great. And that's how you engage with your audience. But that's not the same thing. I was going to connect this with the things that I was saying, the third thing, which is connecting with also what you have said in the classics, which is like, play the best games according to BGG. I think there's a reason why they're in the top. Some of them are classics, some of them maybe not, maybe are a bit newer. But if you have played a lot of those games, if you're not only supposed to play only of those games, but if you play some of them, that adds variety to your and knowledge to kind of your critiques. I think there's a reason why they're in the top, many of them. Many of them is just hype and whatnot. But I think that I connect that very much with what you said about the classics. Some of them are mandatory in order for you to know more about the story of board gaming.
Yeah, I think like a good question one could ask from me is that, okay, well, if you have to play the classics, then what are those classics? Who gets to decide what is a classic? I don't think BGG Top 100 is the place where we decide what is a classic game or not. I think it's so dominated by Kickstarter hype. There's a huge bias for complexity.
Yeah.
And you just kind of see this maybe like this, like the historical baggage that comes with certain games, because this was like, well, this was the first game in this genre and now it just bloomed into something bigger.
For sure. And as a hobbyist, I think we like you know that or people know that like that BGG tends to sway complex and Kickstarter-y. And I think knowing that, you should not just like play the top 100, for example. Mm-hmm. But I think like you should, knowing that you should play different types of game, maybe you should go to the top two player games, top trick taking games, because there's different lists depending on the type of game. And then if you have played already 20 strategy games or 20, I don't know, worker placement games, then stop. Don't touch any more worker placement games unless you want to. And then if you want to diversify, go to this very specific list and start choosing from those top lists, you know? And yes, while they may sway a little bit towards the BGG, I think there's still a reason why they're in the top in general.
Yeah, but if we think about games that are completely missing from the top 100, we don't have a single Rainer Knizia game at the moment in the top 100. Mm-hmm. And I cannot imagine that there's a reviewer or like a board game reviewer in the world who says that, no, Rainer Knizia is a meaningless, force in the board gaming hobby. There is no classic card games or there are no trick takers in the top 100. Mm-hmm. Oh, wait, is there Scout? Scout might be there. Scout is technically a ladder climber, though.
Mm.
One more thing about the BGG top 100 and why I don't think it's the place where you should go look for like games to play if you want to be a professional certified board game reviewer is that I think critics should be the counterforce to non-curated rankings. You know, BGG is the IMDb of board games.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, like if you want to know what's popular, then go check what's popular. Mm. But if you want to have like, listen to an opinion about a game, then you should go listen to an opinion about a game.
That is true. Scout is 101.
Okay.
Currently.
So currently, no ladder climbers, no trick takers in BGG top 100.
Yeah. And I was not saying top 100. I said top games. I do not know because I do not know which. There's some of my favorite games are in the top 1,000, or some of them are even outside of the, I think they're 2,000 something, something, something. So I think it's really hard to say like, hey, you need to play 50 of the top 100. But just like top games, you start still like, I still think there's a reason why they're there. They're famous, of course, and there's like a lot of opinions about the top 100 or top games. But if you go to the different categories and start choosing from those respective top 100s or top 50 or whatever, then you can do a good job of like being like, okay, maybe these are worth checking out as a board game reviewer. But maybe we have a different opinion there a bit. What about Monopoly? It's a classic. Should you play it to be a board game critiquer?
Well, I have not played Risk. I don't even know the rules of Risk, which I know is like a classic game, a part of like a lot of people's childhood. So because of that, and because I like to consider myself as a certified board game reviewer, I would say that no, you do not need to play those childhood games in order to be a board game critic.
But as in like some bars here in Finland, you don't need to have the certification, but somebody in the bar needs to have the certification. I have played all of those classics. So I am the certified Risk player in our podcast. So you're covered by me.
Yes. There has been like an unfortunate small amount of comparisons between games to Risks and Monopoly in this podcast. So I'm hoping to hear more about those comparisons in the future.
Okay.
Something related to that is that in addition to like having a wide variety of games that you might want to play, it is that you might want to play with lots of people. And the reason why I think this is even more important than playing a lot of variety in games, because, you know, you might have that niche where you're just like focusing on this thing.
Mm.
But I don't think you can have a niche with people. If you only play with the same exact people, then it's like you're not changing some like very big variables in regarding that gaming experience, right? Mm. Well, you can do that and you can review games, but I think it should be like a disclaimer that, hey, I only play games with these three other people. Because that's going to affect your experience so much. And your experience is going to affect what you're going to put in writing or put in a podcast.
For sure. And I think that might actually, as a side effect, also make you play very similar games. If you're playing with the same amount of people, maybe the same amount of people like the same type of games, and then you start swaying towards a very specific type of games. So having multiple groups probably also helps with playing a variety of games, playing games that you would otherwise not play because now you're 10 people. So now you have to play social deduction, right? I don't know. Or now you are like playing with less board game oriented people. So you need to play maybe lighter games, not super heavy games. Or now you're playing with super heavy gamers. So now you have to play heavy games. So I think those two complement each other. I had something on my list that I think I don't know how to explain very well, but I think I will change it to talk about the games outside of your professional reviewers and therefore discuss the games, discuss what a game is and be open to different opinions about the game. Maybe you love the game, but you don't talk about it, so then your opinion will not change. But however, if you talk about the game, if you talk about your game experience after the game experience or with other people in the hobby, you will be able to also get a more critical opinion of the game, a more maybe objective opinion of the game in general.
Yeah, that's actually a good point. If you keep all of your thoughts in your head and then regurgitate them on a paper or on a mic, it's just kind of like the first time someone is able to react to them. And in a podcast format, well, your co-host can react, but your audience cannot react anymore. They can like posit a counter argument to your thinking. So yeah, I agree. Like the sooner you kind of like talk things out loud with the people you play a game with, the sooner you're going to get maybe feedback that will point you out like, hey, you might want to reconsider that point there. Or, you know what? You say that this game is random, but have you actually checked the probabilities that this event will happen? Maybe you just like should get good. And related to that, one thing I want to point out is that I think you should be able to look past first impressions. So board games tend to be very vulnerable for bad first impressions. You might be playing with the wrong people. You might get some rules wrong. You might be in a cranky mood. You might be hungry when you're playing the game for the first time. And therefore, you might just have this like really bad experience of the game. And you know what? Like, I think this is like totally fine if someone has like a bad first impression of a game. Like, you know what? That's okay. Like, that thing happened to you. But if you want to make a review out of that, come on. Now you're just being like dishonest with people. I think you kind of like need to be able to see that, okay, well, what if I change my thinking about this in some other way? What if I approach the game from a different point of view? Will that change my impression? You know, what if I play it with different people or with a different player count? Will that change the game?
So you think you should only review games that you have played multiple times?
If I were to provide a negative review for a game, then I personally do want to play that game three times. However, sometimes you bring out a game that I maybe have been able to play only once, but I don't select personally those games.
Yeah, same.
Just so I can dunk on them.
Yeah.
And I think it's also great that then we are able to have this commentary, because then you can also point out those things that I did not see in that game if I have that bad impression. Also, overly positive first impressions are might be also a little bit dangerous.
Yeah.
I have had some games that were like the first time I played those games, they feel like the most amazing game ever existed.
Yeah.
Then I play it the second time, and I'm like, oh yeah, you know, it's good. It's not the best up
there. Yeah, there's something to be said about games that feel great the first time you played it. So it's like it's not maybe super objective, but like there's like, hey, there's something good there at least.
Yep. And we are going to Spiel Essen this year, or at least we're trying to go to. And we're not going to play the games, the demos, two times. But yet, we do want to provide commentary about like what were our first impressions from those games.
Yeah.
And, you know, I think it's just so much about the framing. If you frame it as like first impressions, then they are first impressions. But if you frame it as a proper review where you kind of like discuss the game in depth,
yeah,
you have to be careful with your words.
Correct. Jonas, the last point I want to ask you. Do you think you should consume board game content in order to be a board game reviewer?
I think so. I think what happens in practice is that other reviewers will end up looking at other reviewers' content. And I don't think we should kind of like pretend that is not happening and try to always have this like original opinion about things or not comment on what someone else has said about a game. I think there is a dialogue going on, you know, if people are like voicing their opinions. And I think we should lean into that dialogue.
Is that a requirement to be a board gamer, a board game reviewer?
I mean, none of these are real requirements. Apparently, there is no such thing as a certified board game reviewer. But I think that's going to make your opinions, make your critique better. Because also when you consume stuff from other people, their writing or their videos, you will also pick up certain things about like, okay, what works, what doesn't work. Because one, I think a big challenge with board games and reviewing board games is that, okay, how much time do you leave for explaining a game? And how much time do you leave for like the opinions about the game or discussing the game? And I think like consuming content might help with finding that balance. My last point is that I think you should learn how to provide a point of view if you want to be a board game reviewer. I don't think that you need to tell others how to feel, but I think you should be able to show others how to feel about a game. In practice, what that means is like you can help others to see a given game differently so that they can get more fun out of it. So it's this idea of like Junk Company that we discussed today. I think it's a better experience knowing something about the game and what it's trying to tell you when starting to play it for the first time instead of going into the game with a complete tabula rasa. Because I think you will miss the satire if you don't know that this game is supposed to be satirical. And also, as a player, if you are, let's say, leaning very much into interaction or leaning very much away from interaction, I think listening to a reviewer kind of like discuss a game from a different point of view might help you learn how to explore the other end of the board gaming spectrum and kind of like see that, okay, the games themselves are not going to change. But the way you think about those games, that might change.
Yeah.
Therefore, your enjoyment of those games will change.
Yeah.
And I don't think that's like discussed that much. I'm not trying to like raise critics and reviewers here, but I think they do play a part, even though like much marginal part to board game designers and the people who actually play the board games, but they do play a part in the enjoyment that people end up getting out of games.
Yes, 100%. And I think there's a counterpart of that where sometimes if a game is super hyped by board game reviewers, it can also be like a little bit disappointing that like, oh, maybe your experience is not that great with the game. However, yeah, I do agree with what you said. And in general, I think tends to be a positive experience to hear about a good game and then interacting with that game rather than a negative experience. But I've had the opposite where like the game is super hyped. Board game reviewers say like this great. And then my experience with my group of friends was not that great. And like, yeah, this game is not for us, even though there's several people that are super hyping and people that in general I agree with about a game, for example.
So how do you, Luis, rank against these criteria for a board game reviewer?
I think bona fide certified. Yeah.
What do you think? What are your strengths? What are your weaknesses here?
I think my main weakness is being able to provide a point of view that is fresh and new. I think with more experience doing this podcast, producing writing the reviews, little by little, I'm becoming better at that. I think in general, I thought this was easier than it actually is. And little by little, I think I've been trying to find a better voice and a better way of explaining games and sharing an opinion. I think that would be my main weakness. Maybe also looking past first impressions. Sometimes when there's games that I haven't played that much that you mentioned about, then it's like hard to comment or have a very strong opinion about it. I think playing with multiple people and different types of games and the classics and the top 100s, it's like something I'm good at, I think. And I also consume a lot of content, so. So yeah, I'm maybe a more vanilla board game reviewer yet, but hopefully at some point I'll be a voice, an authority to be reckoned with. What about you?
I think I might be lacking in the same compartments or like the same categories or the things that I struggle with. Looking past first impressions, but I think that's just like human nature. We all struggle with that thing a lot. And the second thing that I do want to get better and better at is like that ability to provide a point of view, to discuss about a game in a different way. to keep things novel and engaging. One thing that we didn't talk about, and I was actually, what's the word? I was surprised to not see this on your list, is money. And are you sponsored by other people? And like all of this, like, you know, can you be a reviewer if you're also sponsored by some board game company? Can you be a reviewer if you have done a sponsored video?
Yeah, 100%. I think you can. I think as long as you disclaim it, like as long as you said it out loud, then hopefully people will have the critical thinking to be like, okay, I'll take this review as it comes from somebody I sponsored by this game. That does not negate that this person might have an opinion. I think this happens quite a lot, for example, with Shut Up and Sit Down, with CMYK Games, the Fosse's and Wilmot's Warehouse and the Magenta series now that came out. Like, they work with them a lot and they put their name behind the product. I think they have said like, yeah, we work together with Money Cares and all of these games. And most of the time they have good things to say about these games. I think most of the time I approach those reviews, I'm like, hey, these are people that work with this company. Therefore, their views might be a bit biased. However, that to me doesn't negate the fact that if they are saying that, if they are backing this game, throughout my experience with their reviews of CMYK games, I agree with what they said. So I'm like, okay, well, I'm taking it with a pinch of salt. But at the same time, I think if they are backing this game, it's because they want to put their name in this game and they are still like upholding the standard of their reviews, in my opinion.
Personally, and I think this is probably also something that you agree with, like it is not a virtue to get paid by or being sponsored by. It's like much more of a con than a pro. However, given the size of this industry, it really seems like so that if you ever want to make some kind of money in this industry, it means that you have to make these kind of compromises a little bit. And since they are so common, these compromises, I couldn't go around and say that no, you know, once you do that, you're out of it. And I know that there are, you know, podcasts, like, so very wrong about games. I think they're very proud of, like, not being financially independent from board game publishers. Same thing with No Pun Included.
No Pun Included,
yeah. However,
Talk Cardboard is a podcast.
Talk Cardboard, yes. However, they have friends in the industry.
Yeah.
And I think if you have friends in the industry, that is at least the same amount of, like, what's the word?
Bias.
Same amount of bias than having a some kind of, like, a financial dependency, like a small financial dependencies. Because, like, if you have a friend who is, like, a designer of a board game that you don't like, you're not going to dunk on that game. You won't taint that relationship.
Yeah, I think biases are an unavoidable part of a subjective experience, which is a board game review. You will always have biases towards the theme, the company, the type of game, many things. And that, as you said, includes, like, minor financial incentives can be a bias. And as long as you disclose them, I think you're not negating the fact that that review can be completely accurate. Mm-hmm. And we do not know what would have happened if you had gotten that game without you being sponsored by the game. Would you have liked it as much as you did? Is that affecting your relationship with the game? Maybe not. Maybe you would have liked the game as much as if you were not sponsored.
Having said that, I know that there are plenty of content creators who are, they just seem to be like in it to get free games. And if you want to get a lot of free games, what you need to do is like, don't anger the publishers. Say only good things about those games so you will keep getting those games.
Yeah.
Like, I know that some podcasts have been kind of like blacklisted from publishers, knowing that, you know, they said a bad thing about this game before. We're not going to send it to them next time. And in like, if you think about like theater reviews or movie reviews, the reason why that's not an issue in those fields is that, especially with theater reviews, there's usually like only a couple local newspapers whose reviews matter. Mm-hmm. So if you, as a theater company, think you can cut out one of those newspapers from your place, like, you're not going to get any publicity for your play. Like, you need that reviewer to come in.
Yeah, I think at some point, I can imagine a couple of content producers or content creators online that cannot be blacklisted. But other than that, most people, most small podcasts, most small YouTube channels are probably like, well, they don't have enough power to know anything about it being blacklisted. But I think that's the beauty of like, hey, I don't care if I'm sponsored. Great if I'm sponsored. But if I'm not sponsored, I can also get these games on my own. Will I get an advanced copy? Maybe not. But I would still be able to, hey, I want to try this game. I want to play this game and I'm going to review this game without caring about whether I get free games or not from the publisher.
So that is how you become a certified board game reviewer. We want to thank you for your time. Our next episode is airing in 2 weeks. In the meantime, you can visit boardgameok.com for more information about the show.
Bye-bye, OK.